This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When an energy project is proposed for construction in the state of Vermont, it's the job of the Public Service Board to determine whether or not the project is in Vermonters' best interests. The board makes that determination based on testimony by the project developer, as well as expert scientists and sometimes affected citizens who've acquired intervener status. But not all citizens think they have enough of a voice in the process. In the fall of 2012, a commission was looking at whether the PSB process should be changed, and we interviewed the chairman of the Public Service Board, Jim Volz. We asked him to comment on the perception that some people have that the board is on the side of utilities who want to build energy projects.
I don't agree, obviously, that we're in the that we're deciding these cases in favor of utilities specifically just because they're utilities. I believe we're deciding these cases in the best interest of the state as a whole, and so I would urge people to look at the orders and see what went into them before they jump to any conclusions.
For some, that's a hard pill to swallow, that what the board determines is in the best interest of all Vermonters may not be the best outcome for a small number of people who find themselves caught up in the development. We've talked in the past about how the PSB process works, but today we're going to speak with one Vermonter who says citizens should have a central voice in decisions around energy projects. Annette Smith is the founder and director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment. She's a polarizing figure. Some people working in the field of renewable energy see her as an anti-wind zealot masquerading as an environmental advocate. But others say she's standing up for the average citizen and opposing projects that they feel will damage the state's environment or communities. Annette Smith joins me today to talk about her motivations and to answer your questions about the role of citizens in energy development in this state. Annette Smith, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. I'm pleased to be here.
Before we get into this, because it can get very complicated very quickly when we start talking about how the Public Service Board works, I'd like to play another cut of tape from Jim Volz about his description of how the process works, and then we can get your reaction. In Vermont, the Public Service Board reviews these energy projects in a process that is sort of similar to a court proceeding. And as we said before, that process was examined in 2012 by a special commission. You were part of looking at how to possibly change that. And here's part of our interview with the chairman.
Because we're quasi-judicial, we conduct evidentiary hearings, which are essentially very much like what would happen in a courtroom. A case starts by a developer or a utility filing petition to develop a particular project. After we get the petition, we set up a status conference and set a schedule for that case. We allow for intervention. Intervention can be by the Department of Public Service is always a party. Agency of Natural Resources is always a party. But others can also intervene if they can demonstrate an interest that's affected by the project under the criteria. And we have granted many interventions for contiguous landowners to projects and things like that. But then once you get the case is set and starts moving, we have to set a schedule. And the schedule has to allow time for all the parties to have a chance at commenting on what the project developer wants to do. So it usually starts with filing of testimony by the project developer, and then there's a thing called discovery, which is where the other parties get a chance to ask questions about what's in that testimony and what the project is about. Then they usually file their responsive testimony. Then the project developer gets an opportunity to do discovery on that testimony and find out what the opposition's positions are. This process is not like Perry Mason. It's intended that for there to not be any surprises. Everybody's supposed to know exactly what's going to happen.
All right. So there's a lot of legal process in that. And if you're listening to it for the first time, it can kind of make your head spin thinking, wait, so what happens in the PSB process? And Annette Smith, you've assisted many individuals who are finding themselves in that position thinking, okay, wait a minute, there's this thing going on and I need to get involved because I feel that I will be affected or that I have a voice that needs to be heard in this process. Can you describe what you think regular citizens are up against when they decide that they need to be involved in this process?
Well, I will add that it's not just citizens, it's towns. There are many towns that have found themselves in a similar position, and it is just as challenging for them. His description of the process was good, but it didn't finish because you have pre-filed testimony by the applicant, you have discovery served on the applicant, you have rebuttal testimony by the applicant, and then you have surrebuttal testimony, you have numerous rounds of discovery. This is not what takes place in court. And so this is, I think, one of my complaints with the Siting Commission was they never actually talked about the process. So if you're in Superior Court or Environmental Court, you either do pre-filed testimony or you do discovery, which includes depositions. You don't do both. You don't do multiple rounds of both. So we have, some people say, a highly litigious process. Well, it is perhaps one of the most legalistic processes that exists perhaps in this country. And it was set up for a central power plant process. And now we're trying to do decentralized energy in a centralized way. And you really, what I find in working with citizens is you cannot do it as a citizen. That you find yourself, if you try to do it as a layperson, the other side has unlimited legal resources and will bury you in paperwork. We're dealing with one case where the neighbors are just received over 250 discovery questions. Compare that with the Vermont Gas Systems case going on right now in phase two, where the Department of Public Service served the most questions of anyone on discovery and at 65 questions. So we see this over-lawyering, taking advantage of the citizens' inability to understand, and there's nobody there to answer any questions for you about how to participate, unlike with Act 250, where you have district coordinators. So there are a lot of ways that this process doesn't work against citizens and towns, and a lot of ways that Act 250 was set up to do that.
Although you can get a lawyer. Citizens who have intervener status can certainly hire a lawyer to help them through this process. They don't have to be lawyerless.
Well, I don't know how much money you make an hour, but I make less than $20 an hour. And the citizens are finding that the cheap lawyers cost $125 an hour. And so it is incredibly imbalanced. If you're brought up on murder charges, you get a lawyer. But if you're in the Public Service Board, and this is a problem with Act 250 too. Now, New Hampshire has a public advocate position that comes from the Attorney General's office, and it's not political. So it's something that we need in, because right now, essentially what we have is one hand clapping. And you're dealing with a board that I sometimes refer to as kind of like the Wizard of Oz. There's a curtain. You know stuff goes on behind the curtain. You really have no idea what it is. And, you know, motion after motion gets filed. Who do you call to find out, well, should I file a response? Are they going to just rule? There's just, it's a very dark curtain that nobody can figure out. You can't call the clerk. She's a very nice person, but she can't give legal advice. And the Department of Public Service, which has what's called an Office of Public Advocate, really is the lawyers. And as I heard one of them say in a public hearing recently, they represent the executive branch. So they work for the governor. So there's a politicized entity representing ratepayers before the board. And then there are citizens who really are completely on their own. And yes, if you want to spend money, we've seen around the Lowell case well over $150,000 spent to intervene. And then when the decision comes out, over and over and over again, we hear it's as though we weren't even there. So there is the process problem, and then there is the fact that when people do raise the money and participate, they feel like they were not listened to.
We're talking today with Annette Smith. She's the founder and director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, and she's been involved on the citizens' side of many disputes in energy cases and other situations before the Public Service Board. And we're getting her take on what that means and how it's done and what she'd like to see changed. We'd also like to hear from you today. You can call in with your questions, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can share your thoughts with us. There's already a robust discussion going on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Will who says, the current PSB process allows for public input. No renewable energy projects are being rushed through. In fact, Sheffield Wind took 7 years to permit, giving regular citizens who don't have the technical background to assess these projects more weight in the PSB process will make renewable energy development in Vermont almost impossible. The state has a goal of 90% renewables by 2050. How are we going to reach this goal without large-scale renewables? Similarly, Robert says, we have this goal of 90% renewables. We need to use the existing Public Service Board process, which does accept public comment, and keep moving Vermont forward towards more renewables. The process will decide if the projects are in the public good. How do you respond, Annette?
Well, this isn't just about renewables. This is the process that we're talking about is about transmission lines. It's about pipelines. We're seeing a lot of difficulty and challenges with the Vermont gas pipeline. At the one of the legislative hearings that was held last fall, one of the interveners in phase one brought in some of her paperwork, not all of it, and it was a stack.
This is phase one of the
gas pipeline.
Addison County.
It was more than 4 feet in height, maybe 5 feet, and she said she didn't bring it all. Maybe we should look at the carbon footprint of all the paper that's generated in this process. I disagree strongly with those claims that the Public Service Board process works in a way that is actually beneficial to the renewable energy industry in particular, as those comments were specifically focused on. I believe that if we have a more collaborative process where people work together, the developers, the regulators in the various agencies, and the people who live in the area, planning commissions, select boards, that we would actually move forward faster. And I believe that this process that we have is an impediment. The idea that the Sheffield project took 7 years to build, and any claims about that being the result of people having been able to have a say, is just simply not true. And the fact is that project had good expert witness testimony on both sides, credible testimony on, for instance, the number of bats that would be killed, where the developer's expert came in and said, for instance, 5, and the citizens expert's UBM professor came in and said 500. And when the decision came out, the board in every case took the developer's information. And so we're not getting good decisions based on the evidence in a way that people can support renewable energy. When you look at the way that we're doing this, the contested case scenario where each side pays their experts, and certainly I've heard one person use the word biostitute. You can pay somebody to say your point of view. I don't think this is productive. I don't think it's necessary. And I think we have a great opportunity, especially in developing renewable energy, to do decentralized energy in a way that benefits our communities. And that gets to a bigger point about who's benefiting from the process that we have now. And so we're building big energy projects that are going into the regional grid. The renewable energy credits are being sold. We are not able, according to Federal Trade Commission guidelines, to call the Lowell Wind Project, for instance, or the GMP Rutland Solar Projects, renewable energy for Vermonters. That violates the Federal Trade Commission laws as long as they're selling the renewable energy credits. And so when Vermonters then look at, wait a minute, what's in it for us? Why are we doing this? And why aren't we looking at, for instance, what Montpelier's doing? They want to have their energy.
Plant.
Well, not only the biomass plant, but there is an effort to have Montpelier be the first net zero energy community. We have small town communities. It's one of the things that is in Vermonters for a Cleaner Environment's mission statement, the preservation of Vermont's natural beauty and its clean rural small town environment.
So you bring up Montpelier, and that leads me to a question that I wanted to ask you is, are there projects that you can point to that you support, that you think are a good project for Vermont, a good way to have both developers and citizens involved in the process, and that you think are successful?
I can't point to any right now, and that's a sad testament. I mean, I live in Rutland County. I'm seeing all this uproar over solar. I'm seeing solar being proposed to be sited on some of the finest agricultural soils in Rutland County. And in that docket, the ag agency sent a letter saying that we don't have the resources and we are no longer going to participate in any public service board cases. I've talked to farmers in Rutland County who said their phone's ringing off the hook with people calling about Massachusetts and Connecticut developers tying up farm fields. There's another case that we're looking at that involves a site that's almost entirely Class 2 wetlands, and the Agency of Natural Resources has already entered into a memorandum of understanding with the developer before the developer even applied for the wetlands permit. The Agency of Natural Resources is actively in the legislature right now saying, we have so much work to do that we don't have the resources to even evaluate these projects. So there's this tremendous disconnect between what's actually happening on the ground that I see every day and what is said. Like, our governor outside of the state will say he's a strong advocate for local control. But town after town after town, and it really doesn't matter what the issue. I've heard the select board chairs say, how is it that three people in Montpelier are deciding the fate of our community?
Well, now, on the other hand, in a situation like Lowell Wind, the townspeople voted in favor of that project. Why is that not acceptable?
Well, these projects have regional impacts, and so it was a campaign on the part of Green Mountain Power in a town that is one of the poorest towns in the state. And on the other hand...
You've advocated for developers to get the buy-in of the community.
And in this case, what you would need to define the community. And the community in this case was Lowell, Westfield, Irisburg, Albany, Craftsbury, and Eden. You know, these are big projects. They have, and even beyond, there are a lot of people who live in towns further afield who are extremely upset by the visual light pollution at night, for instance.
Are you ever going to be able to get everybody in agreement on a project? I mean, there's always going to be a case of we need to have X, for example, we need to have electricity. But you may not ever be able to get buy-in from everybody who's going to be affected. And some would argue that's why the Public Service Board has this role, so that it can figure out what's in the best interest of the community as a whole, even though that may not be the best interest of a small number of individuals.
Well, the process that we would like to see Vermont move to, and it's not exclusive to energy projects. We actually advocated for it in the groundwater protection law in 2008, and we have done it with several other companies in Vermont, is a community-based stakeholder process where instead of two parties sitting at opposite tables staring at a board of people who's going to make the decision, you first start out by all sitting around the table. And that leaves room for those people who will be opposed no matter what. But when you do this process, which is very well articulated by, for instance, Laura Susskind, the founder of the Harvard Law School Alternative Dispute Resolution Service, and he facilitated and hosted a 3-day workshop on the subject of wind development for 100 people. I attended it in 2011. It really doesn't matter what the issue is, but when you rearrange the furniture, have people sit together and do joint fact-finding, agree on the experts to hire rather than paying each side to present your perspective. When you do that, and we have done that with a major multinational corporation, it can have great success. Now, at the end of the day, in the stakeholder processes that I have been actively involved in, I can say that there is, I would say, a 90% improvement, not only in the process through which the information was gathered, but in how it was dealt with and the outcome. There are still obviously going to be people who are skeptical. There's still going to be people who have, not bought into it. And it's not really about majority overwhelming the minority. It is much more about trying to at least have a fairer process that doesn't bankrupt the citizens, doesn't bankrupt the towns, makes it possible for people to actually work together. I think with solar, and solar is our best renewable resource, I'm really disappointed in what's happening with the solar development. And I represent my town on the Regional Planning Commission, and I've said to the solar developers, you are hurting your own business by not coming in first and talking to the town planning commissions,
which they could do voluntarily. This wouldn't require an act of the legislature. Any company can do that.
And I think, to my point, we had a siting commission. We have a legislature. They've heard the complaints and they're not acting on it. It doesn't take an act of the legislature for good people to come together and say, how can we do things? So, for instance, how's solar being done in Rutland County? You have the Rutland Economic Development Corporation going out and finding sites. They're not talking to the planning commissions. They're not talking to the towns to say, hey, do you have an idea of what a good site might be or what would be appropriate? We have energy committees. We have conservation commissions. We have real strong volunteerism in Vermont, and we're throwing all that out. We are not paying any attention to it. And it's really disappointing when it appears that what's coming down from above is get renewable energy bills as fast as possible. But I attended ANR's Municipal Day a couple of weeks ago, and the governor in his opening speech said, and we want to partner with you on energy. And then the four workshops I attended, there was absolutely zero partnership. So this disconnect that we have with let's get energy bills as fast as possible, and then the process that we have that's actually incredibly labor-intensive for everyone and is guaranteed to get the companies their permits, but not, but leave a lot of destruction in its wake. Just as it's not necessary, we don't have to do it this way.
Although I think some people would disagree with your assessment there of what the process is designed to do. But we're going to keep talking about this, and we have lots of people who'd like to speak with you. We're talking today with Annette Smith, the founder of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, and we're getting her take on what it takes to be a citizen involved in the process of figuring out what projects are in the state's best interest and where they should be sited and what they should be doing. We regularly hear from the power companies and other organizations, and we're not leaving them out of the conversation today, but we are taking one day to look at the issues from the perspective of a longtime activist. So if you have questions for Annette Smith, you can call 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211, or share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today I'm speaking with Annette Smith, founder and director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment. She's been involved in deliberations over energy projects that have been proposed in Vermont and are going through the Public Service Board for a certificate of public good. Annette Smith is sharing her perspective on ways the process could be made more accessible to regular Vermonters. And we're hearing from some of you who agree with her and others who find her approach disingenuous. You can share your questions by calling 1-800-639-2211 or by posting on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I want to read you a question we got from Louise, who posted on Facebook to say, make sure these citizens are not secretly funded by certain brothers who are trying to undermine alternative energy development. And I think that's an allusion to the Koch brothers. But to Louise's point, where does the funding for your organization come from?
We're funded by Vermonters, average citizens. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity to say absolutely we do not take any funding from the fossil fuel industry, from the Koch brothers. I have heard this allegation and rumor out there over and over. And if we did get money from them, we'd be doing a lot more. And I'm not inviting that. No, I am very concerned about the health of our planet. And this is not about in any way supporting fossil fuels. I don't want to fight. I've been doing this work for 15 years. We are damaging our communities. We are not building renewable energy in a way that benefits Vermonters. And we are not getting off fossil fuels.
Well, and there are people who work in the renewable energy field who say, but Annette Smith has never supported any of the renewable energy projects that we've put forward. So how do you show that you're not anti-wind, that you're not anti-solar, when none of the projects seem to be ones that, as you said, you haven't found any that you support?
Well, I've lived off-grid with solar for more than 20 years in Vermont, and I walk the walk, I hand milk a cow, I grow my own food, I work out of a home office, I have probably got a very small carbon footprint compared to most people. The whole way that we are doing renewable energy with this top-down centralized approach is antithetical to what the opportunity is for renewable energy. And when we have a governor who on the one hand says we have to build renewable as fast as possible, and on the other hand it says we have to drive a gas pipeline into Vermont, those are the things that hurt us the most. Our earth is in trouble, and we have to address that, and we have to do it in an effective way. We have to do it in a way that will provide meaningful responses to increased greenhouse gas emissions, and we can do that. But
how? I mean, not everybody is going to do the same things that you have and live off the grid and have that very small footprint in that same way.
Well, actually, I think that that's where the technology is headed. Microgrids, wonderful story about Hardwick. Hardwick didn't lose power in the 1960 blackout because some guy said, hey, I'll just flip a switch. This is where the technology is heading. And so the idea of big centralized power plants of any sort just doesn't work. If you go to the public hearings in Rutland around the solar projects, the neighbors are all like, you know, if we could do this in a way that we could all get power, yeah, let's power Vermont. But right now, we're powering Massachusetts and Connecticut, and it may actually be increasing the carbon footprint of Vermont by the way it's being done.
Let's go to the calls. Fran is calling in from Weybridge. Hi, Fran. Go ahead.
Hi. I applaud Annette Smith for being off the grid and doing everything she's done personally, and I believe that that's a very, very important way to go in reducing energy. But I think we need to broaden out here and look at the bigger picture, which is the climate change. That is the problem. And if we if we continue to challenge every renewable energy project that's not a micro power project, we are never going to get to the 90% of renewable energy by 2050. And I believe that this is a crisis. We don't have a lot of time. We're really at the tipping point. So I'm saying we need both. We need micro power. We need the larger projects. We need a full court press to do all of these things if we're going to make a difference in time.
Yeah, Fran, thanks for your comment, echoed somewhat by Kathy Bloom, who's a climate change activist and who posted online to say, we have to get off fossil fuels as fast as possible, which involves a constellation of conservation efficiency and renewable projects and not a fracked natural gas pipeline up the center of the state, by the way. While, of course, renewable energy projects must be imbued with deep regard for ecological and social justice, I'm concerned that Vermonters for a Clean Environment's long history of opposing solar and wind at a scale which can actually meet our growing needs is using their considerable organizing skills to solve the wrong problem.
Well, we don't have a long history of opposing solar projects. And the wind issue we've worked on for 5 years. And I have spent those 5 years trying to answer the fundamental question, do big wind turbines in New England reduce greenhouse gas emissions and fossil fuel consumption? And because we are embedded in the independent system operator of New England system, it depends on the generation resources. Wind energy can reduce fossil fuel emissions when they are embedded in a coal system. We have already, primarily because of the increased use of natural gas, eliminated or dramatically reduced the use of oil and coal. So those savings aren't there. We're focusing so much on electricity and our consumption of the of electricity that has a greenhouse gas emission footprint is about 4 to 5%. So again, through electricity, there's not a lot of savings. The real fundamental point, though, that I think most people miss is that when the wind blows, then other generators are asked to ramp down. And I had the opportunity through the Siting Commission to talk to the CEO of the main ramping generator in New England. And I said, we hear there's a one-to-one offset. And is that true? And he laughed and he said, when my plant ramps down to let the wind in, it's running inefficiently. I said, well, so does that mean you're putting out more greenhouse gas emissions? He said, I don't know. I have to stay within my fuel permit. But then I asked him about the ramping generators that are designed to ramp efficiently in response to wind. And he said, there are not any in the grid. I've asked ISO New England, or I've asked, you know, I've looked at it and it's not cost effective. And then he said that there is a plant that is being shut down in Massachusetts and they're talking about building a new gas plant and that would have ramping generators. Ironically, Conservation Law Foundation, which supports wind energy, filed a lawsuit to stop that plant, and they have now settled. So
effectively, you don't like wind in Vermont. You don't see that as an effective renewable resource for us to be working towards in any project.
I find that after 5 years of really studying all the issues, that wind energy is a disaster, not just for Vermont, but for New England. Back when the turbines were Searsburg size, 197 feet tall, I was all in favor of them. Now they're 400, 500, they're even talking 600 feet tall. These do not belong anywhere near where people live. There are all kinds of noise and health effects, and the wildlife are just, you know, leaving the areas. So
would you like to see small-scale solar and small-scale hydro? I mean, what would you like to see?
Well, I think we can do what we need with renewables, with solar. And I believe that we will need to use some fields. I think that we should first, though, focus on the built landscape, parking lots, flat roofs. This is one of the frustrations I hear over and over in the Rutland Solar. And so what I'm watching, what I'm witnessing, I'm not opposing solar. I'm reporting on what I'm witnessing. Neighbors show up with legitimate issues that they want to support solar, and they were completely cut out. It's brought to the Public Service Board as a done deal. They find out about it months after all the review work has been done with the Agency of Natural Resources, after the power purchase agreement is in place. It's locked into that site, and now we're seeing opposition. And it's the opposition that upsets me.
We got a lot of calls here for you, Annette Smith. Karen is calling in from Essex Junction. Hi, Karen. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you, Annette. I'm really bravo. I'm not involved in the details of this conversation as you are, but I have been outraged at the the fact that one community can put up wind turbines that affect every community all around them, and there's no public discussion. We need to broaden the consensus paradigm. It's not happening, and I think people feel it's politically incorrect to say that a wind turbine is not something that we want to be looking at from, for example, Georgia, from North Hero or Grand Isle or Mallets Bay. It's just, I have not understood how people have the right to take the views away from everyone else, and I really applaud your work.
Karen, thanks for that comment. Appreciate it. We have a note from Andy online who says, I think we each need to ask ourselves the question, what do we want to have on the other end of the wire producing electricity for us? Given that all sources of electricity have disadvantages, we cause something undesirable to be built somewhere. Why is our backyard more precious than anyone else's? Annette Smith, would you like to comment on both Karen and Andy's thoughts there?
Well, you know, I've been working in Vermont communities for 15 years, and it amazes me how people who are hit with a project become the experts. And so people who are labeled NIMBYs are actually the ones who learn the most, and that's frankly how our environment's getting protected these days. So the idea that, you know, what that last question posed was a more theoretical thing. So we have people who live in the cities, who live in Burlington, who don't live in areas that where these projects are proposed, and they don't understand it. And until you're actually faced with it, you might not have any reason to go out and understand the issues. To the caller's point, it's not just looking at them. And one of the problems with the Public Service Board is they don't have enforcement capabilities. So there are people all around all three of these big wind projects and Vermonters living near the Hoosac Wind Project in Massachusetts who are very much being harmed on a daily basis with their sleep disrupted, who have complained and complained and complained. And this afternoon I'm going to the Public Service Board's first workshop on the sound standard investigation, yet they have said we're not looking at anything going back. And so, you know, people who live in communities in Vermont matter. And yes, it is important for people to have a say in what goes on in their communities, and we can do this in a healthy way.
Let's try to squeeze in one more question quickly from a caller. Olga's been waiting on the line from Wells. Hi, Olga. Very quickly.
Oh, yes, thank you. I'm thrilled to get in. I have personal experience with the Public Service Board. Velco had built a tower on our mountaintop right next to our house and took the rights to do that through eminent domain. So we had just gone through this process, and I can tell you, Public Service Board just throws the landowner right under the bus when they do these, and they do, in fact, rubber stamp these projects. What we did in the end is appeal our case to a Rutland jury, and the jury decided that the value of our loss is 40 times greater than what the Public Service Board had said it was. So
Olga, you'd like to see more ability for people like you to have a voice in this, I'm hearing, and I know you have more to say, but let's just turn this back to Annette Smith as we wrap up. You know, Olga's saying here, look, eminent domain comes into this. She's not having much success. What would you like to see, barring a change in what projects are being proposed, Annette Smith, to make sure that citizens like Olga have a say?
Well, the question is, what can people do? I think that we need to... we're going to see, I think, some civil disobedience over the gas pipeline because of how that's been rammed through. That may be what is necessary to get people's attention. We saw that happen on the Lowell Mountain. Maybe people really do need to speak up in a way that gets the press attention and that gets attention. I don't want to see that happen, but I'm afraid the way we're going, that's where it's going to happen. We need to come together. Developers need to come to the table. That's what needs to happen. They need to do their outreach in a different way. This is a message for Renewable Energy Vermont and all of their members. And for those who support renewable energy, we'd love to work with you, and we can work with you in a way that enhances our communities and creates real renewable energy for Vermont.
Barring that, does the state need to put money in for an intervener fund so that people can get involved in the process and not have to pay for it out of their own pockets?
If we are going to stay with the process we have, we need intervener funding. We need a public advocate. I think that all of this would be better done at Act 250, where they already have a database, district coordinators, they have a system in place, and they do not have the public good, and they can't, and they will look at the Act 250 criteria and town plans and give towns a voice in what goes on.
That's Annette Smith. She's the founder and director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Jane, for having me.
We have links to previous shows on energy, including our discussion with Public Service Board Chairman Jim Volz at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Much has been made of youth flight, young people leaving Vermont for better opportunities elsewhere. The state is facing an aging population, lower birth rates, and a net out-migration of its citizens. But if young people are leaving the state, why? And what's behind the decision by others to stay? A recent academic survey asked some of those questions, and the researchers behind it got a lot more answers than they were expecting. Cheryl Morse is a professor of geography at the University of Vermont, and she's one of those researchers.
This project emerged from a conversation amongst several scholars who are based in Vermont and who collectively study Vermont. We're each from a different discipline, and we were working together on a panel about outmigration and realized that there was a gap in our understanding of the stories, the factors that motivate individual people to make the decisions that they do. So we decided to work together to put together a survey, and we thought we'd just send it out into the world and get a few responses, and it would be a nice, tidy analysis, but that's not what happened.
No, you were expecting about 75 responses or so?
Yes.
How many did you get?
We got just under 3,700.
Well, that must have been quite a shock.
It is.
Why do you think you got so many more responses than you anticipated?
I think that people want to talk about Vermont, whether it's a place they grew up and left and haven't returned to, or a place that they chose to stay very consciously and decisively. And everybody wants to tell their story. So I think that's part of it. But I think there's something else about the identity of Vermont and being a Vermonter that we're already seeing in our preliminary analysis here.
Like what? What do you mean?
Well, one of the most interesting questions we asked, and this came from Jill Mudgett, one of the historians who's working on the project, and she made sure that we asked people who left Vermont and haven't returned if they ever feel homesick for Vermont. And something like 80% of the respondents said yes. And then we asked them to tell us what they missed. And there was a whole host of answers. We haven't even had time to really look at all the qualitative answers they gave us. But what really struck us was being able to say I'm a Vermonter is something they miss. And another woman grew up in a small town in Vermont. She's into her 80s now. She left when she was a teenager and got married young to a serviceman who was stationed elsewhere. And although she's lived outside of the state for 70 years, she told us that her primary attachment to the state is that she's going to be buried in the local cemetery where she grew up in Vermont. And the stories like that that really are really pushing us in the direction of looking at how people frame their identity based on where they grew up, even when they haven't spent their adult lives here.
Do you think that's different from other states?
That's the question we're asking ourselves. And every time we engage in a conversation about this, that question comes up again. And we don't know the answer. We don't know if Vermont is exceptional in this regard or if other communities that are rural in nature or have some kind of really strong local identity would produce the same results. We'd love to find out, but first we have to get through this data.
In those 3,700 some odd responses that you got, how do you make sure that you have actually a representative sample? I mean, if you're using social media or using people to spread the word through their social groups, how do you make sure that you're getting lots of different kinds of Vermonters?
That's a great question, and we did not begin the project aiming to get a representative sample. Mm. We were aiming basically just to get stories, to just sort of get a set of narratives that included factors that would explain why a particular person made a decision that they did. However, we did ask questions about gender, age, race, sexual orientation, relationship status, whether they have children, whether they have family in Vermont, their highest education level attained. And because we have so many responses, we can feel fairly confident that we are representing a fairly high number of Vermonters. And the ages range from 15 to 91, for example. So we didn't aim to be representative, but we may just be that in the end.
And the only restriction was you were supposed to be someone who had gone to high school in Vermont or was a resident of Vermont when you were in high school.
Correct.
So what are you going to do with the results as you go through them?
Well, our first sense of obligation is to the people who not only responded, but then took the time to email us directly and say, hey, let us know what you find out. We're really fascinated. So we'd like to get just a very top-level analysis available to those folks and make it available on the web. And then after that, we will be preparing a report that we'd like to present to people in state government and nonprofit who are interested in out-migration issues. And then, you know, being the good academics that we are, we'll hopefully do some publication in the areas of rural out-migration and geography and a few of the other disciplines that we represent.
And these people who responded to the survey, it was anonymous, but you left an opportunity for people to give you their contact information in case you wanted to follow up, and a lot of them did.
Yeah, that was great. It was really heartwarming. 58.1% of the people gave us their names, their emails, their phone numbers, extra comments. And I hope they're not all waiting for a call next week. It won't be coming, but we will probably be following up. As we develop more questions, as we look at the responses, we will be contacting people. And, you know, already from this top-level analysis that we've done just in the last week, we can already see some really interesting findings that we know we're going to try to dig into more deeply when we look at the qualitative results.
Can you tell us about any of those, just the top-level stuff you've already found?
Yeah. One is that we wanted to know, as a lot of people do, how much sort of economic circumstances, cost of living, and job opportunities may play into a person's decision to leave the state and remain outside of the state. And it wasn't as actually as strongly represented in the survey as we might have thought. And in fact, fewer than 20% of the people said that the cost of living in Vermont was too high. That means fewer of the people who left and have stayed outside of Vermont said that, whereas we thought that that might be much higher. And it was more likely for someone to say that their job was located outside of Vermont and they maybe couldn't do that job inside the state. That was more like 37%. The other thing that, as a rural geographer, I found fascinating was that when people described what was important to them, the landscape kept emerging as an actor unto itself. So people would say they missed the rolling hills and the forests and small towns, or they would say that's why they stayed or why they returned. At least in one case, the role of the landscape seemed to be an even stronger draw, or it matched, very closely matched, the lure of family.
So people are really, it is something about the land here that attracts so many people.
There's something about the land, and there's also something about the sense that it's home, that the landscape itself represents home.
This idea of youth flight, this has been an issue in Vermont since we were sheep farming. So are you able to make any connection to why this is such a preoccupation of the state over so many years? Clearly we're a rural state. We're not going to change that dynamic. Is this just something we have to live with?
Well, you're right. It has been part of our contemporary life since shortly after we became a state. So it's not a new process, but it is something that we're always worried about. And I think part of that is the role of homesickness, that not only do those who leave articulate a sense of nostalgia for home, but those who are left behind, of course, miss those who left. And that's not something we can necessarily get at in this survey, but it's definitely a process and that we've been seeing as we look at the literature over time. Why it's a political issue now, I think, is open for debate. And we don't ask respondents to comment on that specifically. We ask them to just tell us what their particular reasons for staying or leaving are.
What about you guys who are doing this survey? I noticed that you all have at the end of your names and your credentials where you went to high school. So it sounds like you all either stayed or came back.
It's true. And when we discovered that, we were delighted to find fellow Vermonters amongst the ranks of academics, because we're not that common around here. And we just thought, honestly, we thought this would be a great project. It'd be fun because we each had our own stories about our siblings or the folks we went to high school with. And the fact that we were from here and discovered each other was sort of the impetus for the project, really. And the fact that we all worked on either youth out migration or rural identity or sociological educational issues kind of brought us together.
What's your story? Did you stay or did you come back?
I did. We realized that there was a mistake in the survey. We should have had not three categories, but four. We have three. We have those who have pretty much always stayed in Vermont, except for maybe some years of schooling or military service or something like that. We have the category of people who left and sort of permanently left the state. Those who've come back to Vermont. And we needed to have like a yo-yo category for those who left and came back. And my story is I did a lot of traveling and working outside of Vermont when I finished college. I went to UVM and then decided that I wanted to settle here and was lucky enough to be able to find a job after I completed my higher education that would allow me to stay.
That was Cheryl Morse, a professor of geography at the University of Vermont. She was explaining the initial results of the Vermont Roots Migration Survey that looked at why young Vermonters leave or stay in Vermont. Incidentally, she's a graduate of Woodstock High School. Go Wasps. We're still getting comments on our earlier discussion with Annette Smith of Vermonters for a Clean Environment. Jamie Stewart is with the Rutland Economic Development Corporation, and he writes in response to say, Ms. Smith made a factually inaccurate statement regarding the role of REDC in siting solar in Rutland County. She stated we worked with the developers to the exclusion of consultation with towns. The Grow Solar project she's referring to is on land defined by the town plan as an industrial development site. We and the Cold River Industrial Park are the largest contiguous abutting landowners to the project and support the development in those areas designated by the towns for commercial industrial development. We've been involved in the discussion on multiple occasions with the town in support of the project. Ms. Smith's claims to the contrary are wholly inaccurate and misleading. If you want to carry on the conversation, go to vpr.net. Thanks for listening today.